The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason.
The advice given by the government to Her Majesty the Queen to prorogue Parliament from 9th September to 14th October was unlawful, and that therefore the prorogation itself is unlawful.
After losing 6 votes in 6 days, Boris Johnson was dealt yet another blow yesterday as Scottish judges declared his decision to prorogue Parliament was unlawful. And then another as the government was forced to publish its secret no-deal plan, Operation Yellowhammer, which predicts public disorder, rising prices and disruptions to food and medicine. With the possibility of Parliament being unprorogued, no deal off the table for now, and no immediate chance of a general election, the Prime Minister is running out of options. Could a Northern Ireland-only backstop be his only way out? Also this week, we talked to protesters outside Parliament about whether the wounds opened up by Brexit can ever be healed, and the economics author Grace Blakely about how to save the world from financialisation. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, the House of Commons witnessed unprecedented scenes on Monday night as MPs protested against the suspension of Parliament with signs saying silenced while shouting shame on you at Tory MPs. There was even a bout of singing. But not so fast. Yesterday, Scottish judges found unanimously that the Prime Minister effectively misled the Queen by advising her to suspend Parliament and that prorogation was unlawful. The government will appeal against the ruling at the Supreme Court next week. What this means is anyone's guess, but after also forcing him to publish yesterday's Operation Yellowhammer documents, Parliament is certainly looking a more formidable opponent than Johnson could have expected a fortnight ago. The narrowing of his options even signalled a change of governmental tone this week, with Boris Johnson calling a no-deal Brexit a failure of statecraft for which we would all be responsible. So what options are now left open to him? Well, I am joined to discuss all this by Raphael Baer from The Guardian, Katie Balls from The Spectator and Grace Blakely from The New Statesman. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
So what does yesterday's decision by Scottish judges mean? And could Parliament be recalled next week? Who wants to have a go answering that one?
Well, there's a very fiddly tactical or sort of technical point I can raise, which is that recalling Parliament isn't actually all that easy once it's prorogued. So you have to, actually the mechanism to do that isn't entirely obvious. But no, the bigger point, I think, is that in law, it has been established more or less that Boris Johnson was lying when he said that the reason for proroguing Parliament was because you needed the Queen's speech and the parliamentary session had gone on a bit too long and there was some agenda other than Brexit that really needed a new session of the Commons. No one really believed that anyway. I don't think, I mean, the ministers and supporters of the government were really struggling to even remember that that was the line they were supposed to be giving when the announcement was first made about the prorogation. Everyone plainly understood that it was because the Commons was an obstacle potentially to a no-deal Brexit and the Prime Minister wanted to get that out of the way. Now, what's interesting about the ruling from the Scottish Appeal Court is that they accept essentially the argument that Boris Johnson kind of weaponized a crown power for a partisan agenda, but decided that that was unconstitutional and therefore against the principles of the Constitution and also really disrespectful to the Queen, if you care about that sort of thing, and therefore the prorogation shouldn't stand. But at the same time, there's been a separate ruling in the English High Court which chose not to judge whether or not Johnson had an ulterior motive. In other words, they didn't. The judges in that case didn't sort of say he wasn't lying. They thought it was entirely possible he was lying. But what they said is that's a political opinion and not justiciable by the court. In other words, actually, you can kind of prorogue for political agenda. It's not very nice. It's still rude to the Queen, but it's not illegal. So now the Supreme Court basically has to decide between the kind of Scots law interpretation of whether or not the lie invalidates the prorogation or the English law interpretation, which is that, yeah, it was a lie, but that doesn't make it unconstitutional.
We are kind of at something of a tipping point in terms of how the British Constitution actually works. I mean, obviously, historically, you have, you know, a set of norms and a set of legal norms and political norms that, you know, suggest there's a particular balance of power between the legislature, the executive and the judiciary, with, you know, parliamentary sovereignty, meaning that the legislature is supposed to be kind of in charge. But like looking back to this is really nerdy, but referencing like the way Bajo thought of the English Constitution, saying that actually power does lie with the executive in the UK, and actually we have one of the most powerful executives in kind of the developed world. So I think this is kind of very much a test of our constitution, and it's not at all clear who's going to come out on top. There's no, I mean, ultimately, I was kind of discussing this last night on Newsnight, what happens next? And if Johnson does try and kind of defy the courts, defy Parliament and go to the EU to say, well, not go to the EU and say anything. And then, you know, the legislature goes to them and says, we want an extension. There's then a question about who speaks for the British state, who will civil servants, who will, you know, officials of the state obey. And that's like a really deep seated like constitutional question with quite a lot of profound implications.
So with Boris Johnson testing the boundaries of the constitution here, it is certainly perfectly possible that the Supreme could rule in the Scottish Supreme Court could rule in the Scottish judge's favour next week. And if they do that, Katie, what are the ramifications of that going to be? And could the government in fact make a sneaky move to bring back Parliament exactly on the eve of Labour conference and try to ruin it?
Well, I think there's ramifications whatever the Supreme Court say. So the first one, which I think is probably before we even get to the consequences for the Tory government, if they lose this case in the Supreme Court, is what if they win it? And I think that if they say the Scottish court is wrong or that does not stand in relation to the English court, you're playing very easily into the hands of the SNP, and you're going to quite quickly see Nicola Sturgeon and her MPs all make this point that, look, we told you we're different than England. We told you this Tory government doesn't represent you. And now the judiciaries, the judges aren't even taken seriously. So I think there are problems for both parties, whatever happens.
If the Supreme Court says that it was that Parliament does, in fact, have to be recalled, happens then? Does it, are we going to see conferences cancelled and which are money spinners for the parties in advance of an election? What would the government do at that point?
Well, I think if they say that this has been unlawful, Parliament has to be returned, then yes, it is problematic for conferences. But I think that if you look at this rebel alliance of MPs, the talk over the summer was they wanted to cancel conference recess anyway. I think the loser from a political point of view, if this is deemed unlawful, is very much the Conservative government. Now, you might have a smaller version of conference go on. You'll have conference with less politicians or fewer politicians because they are all heading and they have to sit in the chamber, and the Rebel Alliance wants to take control of the order paper and do various things. But the biggest headache is for Boris Johnson and his team. Now, they wanted to prorogue Parliament for a few reasons. I think we can all agree that there's a political motive there. But one of the things there was so they had time to negotiate without people trying to tie their hands. Now, the fact that you've already had a law passed to extend Article 50 to try and force Boris Johnson to get a Brexit delay makes it more difficult for them to have those negotiations. But the thing they did want to do is a few weeks ago, the Boris Johnson government was looking fairly smooth, at least compared to now. And you had the situation where because Parliament wasn't sitting, they used the August recess to really take control in terms of the agenda, in terms of pushing their domestic priorities. I think they had hoped this 5-week period would be a time where they could almost get an early general election campaign in. If Parliament returns, I think that we saw the past couple of days, Boris Johnson almost looks like a prime minister who's being tortured on a daily basis, whether it's extending no deal. I think that this group, you know, opposition parties plus some former Conservative MPs who've had the whip withdrawn can agree on a few more things. You've had the humble address to get their communications. There's some talk that you might be able to find agreement for votes for 16-year-olds. I think that if you have that time in Parliament, it's negative for Boris Johnson, and they are going to push and try and undermine him as much as possible.
I think that raises a sort of a bigger question around this, though, which is that the central tension, you know, that you saw yesterday was between essentially a group of people who were sort of celebrating that the rule of law was operating and that they were holding the executive to account, and everyone was having a debate about constitutional propriety. And initially there was a line out of Number 10 saying, well, you know, these basically cockamamie Scottish judges, what do they know? We'll wait for good proper English judges to decide. And that wasn't their words, obviously. And then very quickly realised that was a really stupid thing to try and brief out, and retracted it and said, no, we do, you know. And Robert Buckland sort of said, oh, we do actually respect the rule of law. Now, if a government is in the position of having to clarify that it respects the rule of law and believes in the independence of the judiciary, it's already in a bad position. But for the sort of overarching kind of narrative war that Number 10 and the sort of Johnson operation wants to wage in a general election, that's not necessarily a problem for them. If their position is, we're just the people to deliver Brexit, Boris Johnson is the guy who doesn't care about all that fiddly sort of stuff, and neither do you, and neither should you, because big picture, democracy is defined by enacting the 2016 referendum mandate, and all these people are just trying to find ways to stop it, and we're not going to let them. Now that, I think, in a general election, it's difficult seat by seat, but in a general election, that's a pretty powerful campaign if you run it well and properly, and they might well do that. So actually, I suspect there are a lot of people in Number 10 who are watching some of this thinking, this is fine, this is good for us.
I actually, yeah, completely agree with that analysis. The whole people versus parliament frame has so far played, I think, quite well with Johnson's base. And especially if you have the kind of non-no deal vote split between a number of different parties, then you could potentially see him, you know, mobilising not just people who want to see Brexit delivered, but actually a large swathe of people who effectively feel like British democracy doesn't work. They don't have a voice in the system, and who generally kind of want to give a kicking to the establishment and see, I suppose, see a lot of those institutions out from which they've been excluded for a very long time challenged in quite a substantial way.
And does that pose a problem for Labour, which wants and does pitch Jeremy Corbyn as the anti-establishment candidate? If you've got Boris Johnson also trying to pitch himself as an anti-establishment candidate, who comes out on top?
I do think it presents a problem for Labour, actually, and it's definitely, you can see already, kind of undercutting Corbyn's insurgency. I mean, what the success, relative success in 2017 was built on a lot of those people who do feel, you know, shut out of democracy, like the economy doesn't work for them, etc., going to Corbyn on the basis that he would be the one to kind of shake up the system and deliver, you know, substantive change and kind of give people a voice in workplaces, communities, etc. The idea that now he's lost that sense of insurgency, either because people don't agree with his Brexit position, or perhaps more importantly, they don't trust the way he's come to his conclusions on Brexit. Because I think ultimately, if, you know, Labour had taken a very strong and clear line from the very beginning and stuck to it, then we wouldn't be in this position now, even if, you know, the situation was equally as polarised. Then, you know, people will start to look at the Labour Party, especially when, you know, you've got John McDonnell on the stage with Anna Soubry, Joe Swinson, various other, you know, kind of establishment, in inverted commas, politicians. It does start to chip away at a lot of those votes that Labour does need to hold on to. Having said that, I just saw this morning there was some research out, I can't remember, I think it was from YouGov, showing that people who voted to leave, who supported Labour in the last election, state that they are very unlikely to ever consider voting Tory. That is a problem for the Conservatives. It's less of a problem if they can do some sort of deal or informal arrangement with the Brexit Party. If the Brexit Party can hoover up those votes and go into some sort of, you know, alliance with the Conservatives, which I know a lot of people think won't happen because of the very deep enmity between Cummings and Farage. But that looks to me to be the only way that this would work.
It's a pretty invidious position for the Labour Party to be in, I think, that actually at some level they need Farage and the Brexit Party to be doing well, because that really splits the Brexit vote, and that's sort of their route. That tactical, you know, politics has always worked like that, and that's the way it is. But I think Grace identified a very important sort of structural fault line running through the Labour voting coalition, which is that 2017 alliance, vote alliance, that meant Labour did a lot better than most people expected. It contained a lot of people who were rallying to Jeremy Corbyn kind of because of his message and for all the reasons that Grace said, but also a huge number of people who actually represented the opposite, who were sort of voting Labour because it wasn't a sort of radical Brexit prospectus, and they were Remainers, some of them now are more inclined to be Lib Dem, and actually they take, in a way, quite a small C conservative view of things like what isn't the establishment and how things ought to be. And they're actually kind of anxious about the fragmenting of the status quo and quite want a party that is a little bit more delicate and protective of things that, you know, a more radical prospectus would consider the status quo. And that's just really difficult for Labour to hold that together.
Now, one of the key questions about an election is whether it takes place before or after Brexit. And playing into that, some secret Operation Yellowhammer documents were published yesterday, which reveal what could happen in the worst case scenario of a no deal Brexit. And the contents were pretty toxic for those arguing for that outcome. There were predictions of rising food and fuel prices, disruptions to medicine supplies and public disorder on the streets of Britain. Now, surely this completely rules out a no deal if you're any sensible politician.
I mean, I think you see on no deal frequently, A, in terms of Minister and Boris Johnson's cabinet, but also voters who say they want no deal, they see it as the cleanest Brexit. I don't think they buy a lot of these warnings. So even it might be in a government document, it is still seen as something about, oh, we've heard this all before. We've heard Project Fear in the EU referendum. And then you also have figures like Michael Gove, who's now in charge of no deal, playing down these scenarios as saying as the worst case. So I think Yellowhammer, in a way, it confirms what people who don't want a no-deal Brexit think about it. I sense that with Tory voters and a lot of the Eurosceptic membership, Eurosceptic voters, it doesn't actually move them as much. I think when it comes to this early election, and it's interesting what Grace, you were saying, which is, I do think that this current situation the Conservative Party find themselves in, of all the opposition parties working together, taking control of the order paper, doing things to almost, you could argue, frustrate, to use the word of Boris Johnson's, Brexit, they can play into a narrative in an election, people versus parliament. But I also think that it's true to say that figures in number 10 were blindsided by the fact that Labour wouldn't go for an early election at the date that they wanted to, that 15th of October election. Now, they can still make it potentially work in a campaign, same themes, but it's harder for this government if they have to go for an election after the 31st of October and an extension has been agreed. And people would say, oh, no deal if you had left on a no deal and you had an election on the 1st of November, something once talked about that could have been difficult. Right now, it sounds as though we're heading to an election with an extension potentially, and that, I think, is difficult for Boris Johnson to navigate.
I think Kate's absolutely right that I think, you know, another document saying Brexit would be a disaster is not going to sway leavers who really want to leave the EU very much. But what I think is very more important about it in a way is that this is what privately officials have been saying to government for a very long time. And you do notice generally, you did notice in the period 2016 to 2018, people who are very gung-ho about Brexit, someone like Liam Fox and Michael Gove for that matter, when they got a red box and they sat down and they understood what was actually involved, they became a lot fonder of the idea of getting a deal, because actually no deal is a terrible, terrible idea. And I think that ultimately what that tells you is that whoever sits in behind that desk in number 10 and looks out and thinks, am I really going to push the button on this? Their hand will hesitate. Now, Dominic Cummings, as a strategist, he doesn't care. He might very gladly burn everything down for basically a strategic tactical advantage to win a campaign. But as the person who's responsible for Prime Minister, it's kind of a nuclear option. And I think what that tells you is that Boris Johnson, first of all, he's a bit of a coward anyway by nature, and he will not want to do no deal. And that, I think, changes the dynamic quite a lot, that it is ultimately still a bluff.
If Johnson does attempt to go for a no deal, and obviously if he does this extension with some sort of agreement with the Brexit Party, they will have to go for no deal. The only way for it not to be completely catastrophic would be for a massive stimulus program to take place alongside it, and that wouldn't deal with obviously all the logistical issues. It would just kind of absorb the demand impact, and that would go against decades of conservative thinking on how the economy should work. They would have to rip up everything they've said about borrowing. So, yeah, I mean, this is potentially like a bit of an existential crisis for the party.
Also, it's very difficult, just on a practical point of view, for a fiscal response to have an impact within 2 or 3 weeks if there's basically isn't medicine on the shelves. You know, so the political impact of people freaking out, you know, people get angry when they can't get KFC, as happened when it was last year, a bit of a chicken shortage. If they can't get essential goods and medicines, then yeah, no amount of fiscal loosening is going to save you from the political blowback from that.
So with all this in mind, a lot of people think that Boris Johnson's mind is turning now more and more towards whether he can get a deal and how it can be acceptable to both the DUP, the Eurosceptic rebels, and some of the soft Tories. in his party, as well as some of the Labour backbenchers who are now keen to do a deal. So there's been much talk about a Northern Ireland-only backstop. That was an idea that Theresa May originally came up with, but was ruled out by the DUP, who were propping up her minority government. Now Boris Johnson's lost his majority completely. Could he just simply turn round and betray the DUP and hope to pick up more Labour MP votes on the other side? Is that a possibility, Katie?
I mean, the argument goes, because he doesn't have a majority anyway, what is there to lose? I mean, we had the DUP not always directly, but indirectly threaten to almost bring down Theresa May's government and force her into an early election if she did something they didn't like on Brexit. Clearly, that wouldn't work, because you have a situation where Boris Johnson is trying to have an early election. I still think the numbers, though, don't really add up on this. And there might just be scepticism from covering Theresa May three times trying to pass a Brexit deal. But the number of Labour votes you would need, I mean, I've had some people say there would be 40 Labour MPs who would vote for a Brexit deal. I find it hard to see exactly where that's coming from. I think potentially you could get 20. But even then, speaking to a few Labour MPs, you look at Boris Johnson, and he is seen as someone who it's worse to be associated with than Theresa May. And no one wants to be particularly associated with Theresa May. You also have Labour moving to a slightly more pro-EU position, or at least people trying to push Jeremy Corbyn in that position. And I just think the wider picture, because then you move to the Conservative MPs. So how many Conservative MPs say if Boris Johnson even tried to do this, and we're not sure that he would go for a Northern Ireland specific backstop? I think that if you look at the Brexiteer side, there are plenty of people like Steve Baker, Marc Francois, who have issues with the withdrawal agreement that go well beyond the backstop. And you also look at the Brexit Party, which the Tories clearly do see as their biggest threat in a general election. And this idea of trying to pass something quite similar to Theresa May's deal, I think would worry them, in terms of if you look at how they polled in, you know, the European elections before they made this pitch saying no deal wouldn't be such a problem if they couldn't get this great deal. Boris Johnson, on his replacement for Prime Minister's questions, now Parliament is suspended, so his Facebook, where they take pre-selected questions, also appeared to rule out the idea. And then just a final bit of negativity, I think, which makes me think it perhaps won't happen, is what changes would he need to the Northern Ireland backstop? Because there's some talk that they could find some common ground on agriculture. But if you actually see what Boris Johnson has said on the fact that he couldn't have Parliament tie his hands by passing a law to extend Article 50, because then he wouldn't be able to get large concessions out of Brussels. Well, he can't move as far as they want on a Northern Ireland backstop. It's not even clear he wants to stick to it. But are they going to give him the big concessions he needs? I think it's very unlikely, because if you look at the various polls that have hung Parliament, if Brussels hang on in there is a good chance you get a new government who would potentially go for a full customs union or just remain. And therefore, I think everything is working against us.
I think it's worth adding also that one of the dynamics that's changed a lot, I mean, first of all, I agree, I think, with Katie's pessimism about whether or not a deal is going to get through this Parliament by the 31st of October. That's pretty tall order. But something that has definitely changed in the last 6 to 8 months is that the EU27 side do basically really want the UK out of the EU now. I mean, if the culturally there was some transformation in British public opinion, and Remain was polling at sort of 60, 70%, 80%, and there was a referendum, and essentially the UK underwent such a sort of a moment of a conspicuous regret that it craved a re-entry, or really wanted to embrace the European project in a profound way. Obviously, the Europeans would be very glad to see that, and you know, the diplomats will say the political symbolism of a country trying to leave the EU and then changing its mind would be very powerful. So that the EU is not going to push the UK out, but ultimately the immediate priority now for every European government is to just get this done, and ideally as sort of cleanly with transition and in an orderly way as possible. But really, patience with the Remainers, patience with these parliamentary rebels is really low. I mean, you'd speak to European diplomats and they say, look, it's very touching that these people don't want no deal, and you know, we love that they love the EU this much, but really they're not saying what they want, and they're just, all they can say is no. And actually it's pretty tedious, because it's not really helping. There was a brilliant image that I wish I'd come up with myself, but I didn't, which someone described as basically the sort of rebel alliance behaving to the European Union like the cat that comes in and brings a dead mouse and drops it on the kitchen floor, as if to say, look what we've done, it's brilliant. And they're going, it's a dead mouse. What am I supposed to do with that?
Okay, well, thanks, everyone. We will have to leave that there.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Now, Parliament may have temporarily shut up shop, but the protests outside continue. For the past 3 years, the regular presence of politely warring Leave and Remain supporters on College Green has become a familiar part of the Brexit landscape. But if Boris Johnson does manage to get a deal with the EU, will this mean the end of this particular political sideshow? Or are the divisions running through British society now too deep? Guardian political correspondent Peter Walker headed down to College Green to find out.
Since the Brexit debate started, one of the constant features of life outside Westminster, outside Parliament, has been people with placards, often very shouty people with placards. Some are in favour of Brexit, some are incredibly against Brexit. And they usually rub along, you know, reasonably well. They sometimes shout at each other. Arrests even happen occasionally. But no one's mind ever seems to get changed. So I'm going to try and talk to a few protesters on both sides of the argument to find out two things. First of all, what do they hope to achieve? And basically, where's it all going to end? Is anybody ever going to agree with each other over Brexit at any point in the future? I'm now on the bit outside Parliament known as College Green, where a lot of noisy protesters are, and where all the gazebos, where the broadcasters are based, so a lot of protesters congregate. I'm joined by Jeff from Milton Keynes, who has a very large, it's not rude to say homemade sign, saying traitor Parliament, and you're saying it's the 33rd day you've been here in the last few months. Traitor's quite a strong word with basically kind of legal implications. What do you mean by traitor, just out of interest?
It is a very strong word, and I thought very carefully about what I was going to say, and I mean it. And if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, traitor is somebody that goes against the wishes, goes against the country. Now, the country can be the people, the monarchy, the government. In the context that I've written this, it's against the people. These people in Parliament, the majority, are actively working against the interests of the people. We told the parliamentarians on the 23rd of June 2016 that we want to leave the EU. For the last 3 years, these traitors, as I call them, the majority of Parliament, are actively working to rebel against the people. This is rebellion. It's open rebellion against the people. That is what this is now about.
Another thing that interests me is that in the long term, how do we reconcile people? Because currently the country is a split. Probably less along party lines, but more kind of cultural political lines than I've ever known. And one of the interesting things people talk about is the idea of losers' consent. That if a majority wins, they should perhaps try and accommodate the losers in some kind of way. If you were talking to a member of the 48% who did not want Brexit, what would you be offering them? What losers' consent? What reconciliation would you be offering? Because traitor doesn't sound very reconciliatory to me.
I'm here to stop confrontation. I'm here to stop civil disobedience, because that is where this is heading. People have got to realise that that is the slope that we're on, and it's much better to jaw than war. That is where I'm coming from. And this placard is designed as a bit of a warning to the parliamentarians in particular and the Remainiacs around here that talk vile abuse about what can happen in this country.
Do you think terms like Remainiacs are helpful in terms of reconciliation?
It's a phrase that describes the feeling of people like me who come down and listen to this abuse on these
people. But it includes the word maniac, which implies people are mad.
Yeah, well, we do think that. Part of the reason for this placard is to defend free speech and democracy. And I'm pleased that my fellow countrymen have voted to leave the tyranny of the EU.
I want to challenge this man.
Excellent. Well, I will turn the microphone off and I'll let the arguments continue. Yeah. I think we might be closer to arguments rather than reconciliation. Yeah. On that gloomy note, I'll go and talk to someone else. I'm now about 100 metres further down the road, near to some very eccentric people. Not you, obviously, but there's a man down there who says Brexit is justified by the Bible, which seems slightly odd. I'm joined by Elspeth and Joe, who have got, you know, the Stop Brexit, Bollocks to Brexit, plus Union, EU flags, etc., etc. So it's fair to say you're both more on the Remain side of the fence.
Absolutely, yes.
And one thing that really interests me is that, I mean, you're obviously fairly regular here. In the most basic terms, what do you think this will actually do? Are you a kind of reminder to MPs it's not just Brexit out there? What are you hoping to achieve?
For me, it's about visibility. It's visibility to MPs, to the House of Lords, but as much as anything, it's visibility to the wider public across the UK. They can see we're here. They can see that people are still having that discussion.
And it seems quite split down here, and I know this isn't representative of the whole country, but even the political discourse is quite brutal at the moment.
It is quite brutal, because when you have people in the House, including our previous Prime Minister, talking about betrayal, betraying an election referendum result, talking about queue jumpers and whatever, they have weaponized people on the streets, given them permission, let's say, to call us traitors, to call themselves patriots, I'm not sure what that means, and to call us traitors. We've got a lot of distance to travel. Having said that, we've all been on a massive learning curve of how to find middle ground. And the fact is that all of this has come about because people were unhappy with how things were in the UK.
And there were some very genuine issues.
Absolutely.
Which motivated them.
But we hear regularly of people blaming the EU for all kinds of things, homelessness, price of houses, things that have got nothing to do. And the problem is across the road, of course, with Westminster. No, none of us think the EU is perfect. So we've had to learn how to have conversations, normal conversations with leavers, and find a common ground. The way forward, I'm really not sure, because our urgent mission is to put a stop to all of this.
But it is interesting that, I guess, the two of you are part of this kind of microcosm stroke social experiment of,
yes,
people who believe most strongly on both sides of the argument,
yes,
forced cheek by jowl every single day. I mean, how's it going?
as one of the lab rats, yes, I think what the reality is, there is a huge amount of positivity.
Yeah.
So there's a huge amount of positivity from meeting people from all over the country who come here to protest, all over the Europe who come here to protest, where you see actually the best of some of the people, you know, within the country, which is that creativity, kindness, support. And like I said, even with the leavers, we share our jelly babies. We're not, you know, we're still people trying to find the best way through.
On that incredibly hopeful note, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Peter Walker there. So the Leave camp say that the public want them to get on with it and get a deal, and the Remain camp just want to come out of this whole situation, revoke or a second referendum. Will this argument ever end?
I don't think so. I mean, perhaps one day when we've all passed away and left this world. But I do think, negative note for this podcast, I do think as long as we'll be around this table for in years to come or just writing, we'll be talking about Brexit. And even if you, for some reason, had the Liberal Democrats win a general election and revoke, and you didn't even have to go through a second referendum, the waves that would send across the country, the dissatisfaction in terms of Leave voters, this issue wouldn't suddenly disappear. And if you do have a Brexit deal or a no deal, I think you're still going to have people who, I mean, the hope is among the government that people would say that issue is resolved. But I just think it's gone so deep into how people feel about politics now that it's very hard to see a point where you're not going to have a party which doesn't have a position on whether it's rejoining or leaving.
I think one thing that strikes me about this, now this is a dangerous analogy because it involves war and I hate military analogies, and particularly this is, you know, the Vietnam War, which is an atrocity and a gruesome thing, but if you can just park the slight inappropriateness of that, it does feel like we have entered a policy decision as a country that is so divisive and messy in that way that the Vietnam War was for the US, that you sort of go in so deep and you reach a point where actually there isn't even a route back. Even if you try and go back, you have a whole different set of problems, and then it turns into this kind of culture war in the country. And I think it will be as divisive for British society as that war was for the US. People will just be, it will then filter into all sorts of other culture war issues. And yeah, I agree with Katie, this is going to be with us for a long time.
Okay, thanks all. So before 2008, the last time that there had been a run on a British bank was 1886, when a now long forgotten bank folded after their appeals to the Bank of England for support were ignored. But over 100 years later, Northern Rock was saved in the largest bank bailout in history. The Bank of England intervened this time around because the UK economy is more reliant on banks than ever before. And in Grace Blakely's new book, Stolen, she looks at the growing dominance of the finance industry over the UK economy, what it means for our society and politics, and how to fix it. Grace, what would have happened in 2008 if we'd allowed those banks to collapse?
That is a very good question. It would have spelled disaster for the UK economy. Those banks controlled not just, there was obviously deposit insurance, so people could have hoped to kind of get their deposits back, but those banks controlled the payment system, which would have collapsed. There obviously would have been a massive contraction in lending. There's kind of no telling, really, what the ramifications would have had for the rest of the financial system as well. Those banks were heavily integrated into international financial markets. It would have had implications for, the US, Europe, all over the world, especially the Royal Bank of Scotland, which was the largest company in the world on the eve of the financial crisis after it merged with the Dutch bank ABN AMRO in a pretty reckless expansion drive under Sir Fred Goodwin. So it wouldn't have been a good idea probably to let the banks collapse. The question is, how did we bail them out? And did we then use that opportunity to build a finance system that works for the majority rather than what we'd had before, which was one that largely works in the interest of a very small elite? And we didn't, because, yes, we nationalized the banks, but we didn't require them to increase their lending. We didn't make any requirements about the way the corporate governance of those banks was supposed to be working, even though they'd been shown to be really flawed. There weren't really any requirements around executive pay, and you started to see people getting very angry about that in the wake of the nationalisations. And we've sold off RBS shares and all the other assets that were were taken into the government at much less than what they could have been worth to the taxpayer, which has really contributed to all those problems we've been talking about in the rest of the podcast, about people's trust in government, their belief that the economy works for them. What we could have done is use those nationalized banks to direct credit to parts of the economy that needed it, to lending to small businesses, to alleviating regional inequality, all these sorts of things.
So in effect, we let these banks off too lightly back in 2008 onwards. Did we learn any lessons at all?
We absolutely did let the banks off too lightly, but that wasn't even, the most significant error, really, that's taken place over the last kind of 10 years. Because not only did we let the banks off too lightly, fail to reform the finance system, and fail to give people the sense that, whilst they had been suffering from the crisis, those who'd caused it were suffering as well. We then inflicted, completely unnecessarily, a decade of austerity on the British people in order to pay for the debt accrued from those bank bailouts. It's amazing that at the time there was so little discussion over whether or not it was necessary to cut government spending in order to pay back the debt that resulted from the financial crisis. And what we now know is that the failure to spend, the failure to invest, has actually constrained growth in the economy, has perhaps more importantly created some severe problems around productivity. We're not really investing as a country. We're particularly not investing in things, in fixed capital, to the things we need to produce things. And that's created a really severe productivity problem. And it's reflected in poor wage growth, in the general poor performance of the UK economy as well. So there are a whole series of what you could describe as mistakes, but in the book, I don't describe them as mistakes. I describe them as kind of fundamental to the logic of the economic model that we've been pursuing really since 1979. Which is to make the wealthy, people who own assets, wealthier and not really care too much about what happens to everyone else.
So is there any sense in which we can say that this led to Brexit or contributed to Brexit?
Absolutely. I think the anger left over from the financial crisis and that was exacerbated by austerity massively contributed to whether or not certain portions of Leave constituencies wanted to leave the European Union. There have actually been studies that show that those who are most impacted by austerity were also most likely to vote to leave the European Union. And now, obviously, as we know, the Leave coalition is diverse. There are lots of people who, you know, baby boomers with huge amount of equity stored up in their home who are very wealthy who voted to leave the EU, perhaps because they didn't think that it would do much to impact their wealth. And that question of sovereignty motivated them. But there are others for whom things couldn't get much worse. There was a story a Labour MP told me a while ago about being in her constituency and talking to people about the negative impact of no deal. And one of her constituents said, look, I'm on a 0 hours contract. I earn basically less than minimum wage in some weeks. I don't think things can get any worse for me. So these kind of, you know, warnings are falling on deaf ears.
And in the book, you set out various solutions to this. Can you take us through some of them?
Yeah. So firstly, I argue that, I mean, effectively, the book argues for a big shift in wealth and power away from the people who currently monopolize it, which is largely a kind of small financial elite, and towards the vast majority of people. Now, the way I do that is I argue for a kind of constraint on the current power of our finance sector, which means properly regulating the banking system. And I go through a whole load of arguments for that in there. Also properly regulating non-bank financial institutions and constraining the power of kind of other forms of rentierism. So people who live off the wealth derived from existing assets rather than producing new things. So like landlords and property developers, for example. And I then argue for the creation of new institutions that kind of in which that new balance of power is evident. And one of the biggest things I argue for there is the creation of a people's asset manager. So at the moment, our pensions go off into our pension funds, and those funds then send that capital off to big asset managers. And they invest in lots of different areas of the economy. They buy up shares in corporations, they may lend to corporations, they may lend to governments, etc. And in doing so, they get a huge amount of power over how the economy is run, because, you know, they have an ownership stake in a lot of different corporations, and they obviously lend to a lot of different economic actors. So my argument is, why don't we have a democratically owned and run asset manager that invests on behalf of people who are saving for their pensions on the one hand, and on behalf of the British state on the other? And that would then allow us to direct investment into areas of the economy that needed it, and steadily kind of socialize ownership in the economy. So get to a point where you don't just have a tiny number of people owning all the stuff and lending it out to everyone else, but where everyone has a stake in economic growth.
You're talking about socializing ownership here. Do you think there's any sense to which people in society still worried about the word socialism, think it's a dirty word, particularly maybe among the older generation?
There probably is. And I think, you know, partly that's to do with the fact that, you know, we got to 1989, and there was this pervasive sense that history was over, capitalism had won. There was no question about there being a kind of long battle between capitalism and socialism anymore. People got very used to the idea that capitalism was all there is. But for my generation, that is absolutely not the case. You know, not only did we see capitalism, you know, reach the brink of collapse before our very eyes in the financial crisis, but since then, we have seen slowly the emergence of a lot of credible voices arguing for a very different way of organizing the economy, whether that's, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the US and to an extent Bernie Sanders in the US, Corbyn in the UK, you know, Podemos, Syriza, or other parties that exist in Europe. There has been a steady rise in support for socialism. And actually, when you poll support for socialism in whether it's in the US or the UK, you get surprising results that you definitely wouldn't have expected a couple of decades ago. So I do think that that is changing. And the more that we talk about it and actually talk about what this concept means, which is basically giving wealth and power back to working people, to people who live off a wage rather than people who own the stuff and live off the wealth that they derive from that.
Thank you, Grace. And Stolen: How to Save the World from Financialization is out now. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Raphael Baer, Katie Balls and Grace Blakely. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Rowena Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.